It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. A couple of weeks ago, the budget office for the mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, came out with some numbers that are grim. The city is now projecting a budget deficit of $223 million for the rest of its fiscal year. The next year is looking even more dire as the city faces a shortfall of nearly $1 billion. But when reporters asked Governor J.B. Pritzker Tuesday whether he had talked with the city and whether it had asked for relief from the state, he said, quite simply, no. Pressed, he offered a few additional thoughts on the situation.
I know how difficult this situation is, and I certainly sympathize with it. The state of Illinois provides billions of dollars to the city of Chicago every single year, and we're going to continue to do that, but we can't just, you know, snap our fingers and somehow money. We don't print money at the state level. As you know, they do at the federal level.
All right. We are beginning our Friday Politics Roundtable with this topic this week to talk about not only how it affects the city of Chicago, but how it could affect everyone else in Illinois. Joining us for that is Amanda Vinicky, who covers state government for Chicago Tonight, the news program on PBS station WTTW. She is also the host of Chicago Tonight's Week in Review. Amanda, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you too, Brian.
Amanda, how did Chicago get into this pickle?
Well, this is, I think, long-running issues that are catching up with the city. It is not coming as any particular surprise, although sometimes I think when you hear a number like $1 billion, it gives you a big gulp. Part of this is, again, just long-running and similar to the state. Chicago has some problems paying its pensions. One of the markers for this year's budget cap has to do with Chicago Public Schools not coming forward with its full pension payment. There's sort of this back and forth between who's responsible for that, the city of Chicago or the school district, as they are separate entities right now, CPS more couched under the city's umbrella. But this November, for the first time, you're going to have, as is done in the rest of the state, members of the school board elected versus being appointed by the mayor. At least initially it's going to be half and half, but nonetheless, you're seeing the city and state try, or the city and the school district, that is, try to disentangle themselves. So that's part of it. But I think it also has to do with a lack of additional funding from COVID and the federal government that has helped to keep programs abreast or start new ones that were embedded into the budget. And there is a desire to continue these programs, particularly by a mayor who has passed the budget for the 2024 fiscal year and named it the people's budget, really ran on a platform of investing in people and trying to spend dollars and very much direct them to historically disinvested communities and neighborhoods in the city, those where residents are primarily Black and Brown. And he is not wanting to cut any of that. So those are some of the challenges that got the city to this point.
One thing that has been covered a little, this may be kind of inside baseball. I do think it's interesting that Mayor Johnson's Intergovernmental Affairs Office, which is a fancy way of saying the lobbying entity for the city that works with people in state government, for example, and other units of government, it's going through a shakeup. And one reason this is interesting is that the mayor has not had a super tight relationship with leadership in state government the way, I mean, certainly, you know, a couple of generations ago, House Speaker Michael Madigan at the time and Mayor Daley in Chicago were super tight. And, there were always people looking out for Chicago's interests in the General Assembly. Talk about, you know, the shakeup and that relationship in general and what that could portend here.
Well, I think you have a lot there, Brian. There is the notion of the shakeup on the team and the individual who left had previously actually worked in the General Assembly, so did have those legislative ties, versus the group that is going to be taking over. There are some people on that team who have experience working with the legislature, but the one who is really sort of taking over is a woman aligned with the progressive movement in the city, more so than any sort of Springfield ties. And so I think you have that going on. You have the budget challenges. You have this shakeup. You have, from the onset, not a particularly close relationship, it appears, between the mayor and the governor. And this is something that I've been watching. You have both of them saying, we get along just fine, including just earlier this week. That was among the other comments that Governor Pritzker made when pressed about their relationship. He said, you know, the media likes it, makes it out to be as if we don't get along, but we do. That said, they have interests that are decidedly not aligned. I think that you have Mayor Johnson ran as a progressive, very much wants to move that progressive agenda. And that's complicated for a governor who has taken a more pragmatic progressive approach. And so as the mayor of Chicago goes about that, it puts the governor in a more difficult position. And you're seeing that play out in a pointed fashion right now, where the mayor and the Chicago Teachers Union that helped get Brandon Johnson into the fifth floor of Chicago City Hall, both by working hard and a lot of campaign dollars, and remains close and allied with him. He had worked for the CTU previously, continually calling out Governor Pritzker and the state, saying, you owe us $1 billion, getting back to this discussion for Chicago public schools. So I do think that there is, we're sort of seeing the opening gambits of a potential battle that is going to be playing out between the city and the state, even though you have a lot of legislators from Chicago, of course, in Springfield, even though they're all Democrats, even though I think when pressed, you would have them agree on many areas of priority. How they would go about it is very different, and particularly how they how the mayor's office and the governor's office, the importance that they give for, say, fiscal stability and balancing a budget, that are prioritized in very different ways.
Last question, which is, and this gets to the question of state government and its role, and if Johnson were to go to Springfield and ask for more money, why should people outside the Chicago area, outside of Chicago itself, care about the financial struggles of the city government?
Well, I think people outside the city of Chicago should care, because it is an economic driver for the rest of the state. Illinois is wholly different, as has come up in plenty of these discussions, where you have those who want to separate the state in two. What that would mean for central and southern Illinois without Chicago, it would be there would be a great loss of funds. So what happens in the city impacts the rest of the state. And yet we are, I think, unsure what at this juncture is going to happen in the city of the state. Mayor Johnson ran on a campaign to not increase property taxes, but has not at this point ruled it out, as he's looking at this year and then next year's deficits. And by the way, it's not just next year. There's expected to be budget holes going forward in the future. So there is a matter of import there, and the asks being made by Chicago of the state. Thus far, those requests haven't been formally made beyond the school budget, which of course is huge. You've got property taxes going to schools. And so what Chicago, I think, is trying to do, its strategy, is refocusing not just that more money is needed for CPS, but that more money is needed for all schools in Illinois. When it's making this ask for potentially, and making the ask anyway, for additional money for the city budget, well, you're going to expect Chicago to say other municipalities deserve that too. It's going to be hard for other towns and cities to say, oh no, we don't want more from the state. But the bigger the ask, the harder it is for Chicago to get a return on that, the harder it is for the state of Illinois to appease those requests.
Amanda Vinicky covers state government for WTTW News in Chicago tonight. You can always catch her weekly on The Week in Review. Amanda, always great to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time.
I'm happy to.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. We move now to national politics, and joining us, as always, is our Washington correspondent, Linda Kenyon. Linda, welcome back. Happy Friday.
Oh, well, happy Friday to you.
So we'll get to some bigger policy news in a moment, but we've had a couple of days now to think about and the Trump-Harris debate. Briefly, what effects have we seen on their respective campaigns in the aftermath of the rumble in Philly?
Well, you know, it's always politics is so subjective. Depending upon whom you ask, the Democrats will say they won. The Republicans will say they won. But the consensus, quite frankly, is that Vice President Harris did a very good job and former President Trump was unhinged and lost the debate, which brings up all kinds of speculation about whether there will be a second debate.
Interestingly, speculation is about a second debate, whereas the Democrats were speculating about whether to replace their nominee. Different time in the cycle, and I guess we all know that's not going to happen on the Republican side, but just wanted to note that. You know, we talked about this on Wednesday, but where do you think? Do you think there is, or what have you heard reporting-wise? We saw the Harris campaign say immediately, yes, we'd love a second debate. Where's the Trump campaign on that?
Well, the Trump campaign has vacillated depending upon the day. One of the things that was highly unusual was immediately after the debate, Harris called for a second debate and was very confident and knowing that basically she won the debate. Trump immediately went to the spin room, which is highly, highly unusual for a candidate himself or herself to go to the spin room. That's where all the reporters were gathered and all the interviews were being done with mostly surrogates for the candidates. And for the candidate himself to do that is pretty telling that he felt this was something he had to do on his own. And he spun, as they say, in the spin room, talking about how he did so well in the debate. But he did not do so well in the debate. And so he was saying there will be a second debate. Then he was saying there wasn't going to be a second debate. And again, depending upon the day, his most recent postings on social media are there will be no second debate. And then he goes on further to say, I already had a debate before the one with Harris. Of course, that was the debate with President Biden. And that was the debate that ultimately led to President Biden to step out of his race for re-election.
He really does seem to be sort of pining for the days when he was running against Biden. I guess I don't want to get into the psychology there. We should spend a little time talking about policy stuff because here we are again. I feel like we've had listeners. This is not on tape. This is a new conversation, but we are facing the prospect of a partial government shutdown at the end of the month. September 30th, spending authority expires. There was going to be a vote on at least a temporary spending plan this week, but the Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson postponed that. What's happening there?
Yeah, House Speaker Mike Johnson wanted to put a six-month continuing resolution on the floor, and that is a bill that would fund the federal government at the current funding levels and continue those funding levels for 6 months. Now, this is necessary because, once again, Congress has not finished its work in time to put forth a new budget by the end of the current fiscal year, which, as many know, is the end of September. So if they don't have a new bill in place by October 1st, there is a government shutdown. So they pass these stopgap spending bills called CRs or continuing resolutions. One of the things that was going to be attached to this CR was the SAVE Act, which is a bill that requires people to show proof of citizenship in order to vote. Now, it's already illegal for people who are not citizens to vote. And the Senate made it very clear that if the CR had this this continuing resolution had this citizenship method, this SAVE Act, which former President Trump says he wants on the bill. Keep in mind, he's not president right now, but a lot of Republicans do want to do what Trump wants them to do. And so the senators said, nope, we're not going to pass it. And why? Well, because it's considered by many to be a voter suppression method. A lot of people of color do not have IDs, for example, like driver's licenses. They may live in inner cities and they don't drive. So it's very hard for them to get IDs. And that is why this SAVE Act was going to sink the entire bill. So House Speaker Mike Johnson got a lot of pushback on that issue, also on defense spending from defense hawks and basically members of the Republican caucus, all sides of his own caucus. So he pulled the bill and he decided, I'm not going to put a bill on the floor that I know isn't going to be passed, because not the least of which is that would be very embarrassing. So he did mention that he wants the lawmakers to stay in town and work over the weekend and work on another CR, probably maybe a shorter one, maybe one that does not include the concerns that the defense hawks had with the other CR, and maybe they can put something on the floor. But keep in mind, they want to get out of town at the end of September, and they have to vote on something, or there will be a shutdown, and that could have a lot of pushback against them, especially in an election year.
Especially in an election year. Linda Kenyon, thank you as always. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you. You do the same.
More to come here on the 21st show after a short break. We have a return visit from Joy Yang, who is a theremin player. She's opened an interdisciplinary arts studio. We'll have a conversation about that. Stay with us.